It's here and now. And a warning to listeners, our next story contains graphic descriptions of violence. Eric Garner, Freddie Gray, Michael Brown, they are some of the black men who have been killed by police or died while in police custody. But perhaps, too, we ought to be thinking about Sandra Bland, 2015, Prairie View, Texas. She was pulled over for a failure to signal.
I'm going to drag you out of here.
So you're threatening to drag me out of my own car?
Get out of the car!
And then you
I will light
me?
You up! Get out!
Wow.
Now!
Wow.
Get out of the car!
Sandra Bland was arrested. 3 days later, she was found dead in her cell. Officials ruled it a suicide. Or what about Roseanne Miller, 2014, New York City? Police told her she had to move her barbecue to the backyard for a family cookout. She was 7 months pregnant when an officer put her in a chokehold.
It's a pregnant woman, you know? She's a pregnant woman. She's a pregnant lady. Why are you handling ladies pregnant? Are you stupid?
There's also Alicia Thomas, 2012, Los Angeles.
Put your feet over there and put yourself
in. Okay, good.
You know what?
If
you put a
feedback in
for
it. Okay. No.
Officers kicked Thomas and struck her while she was in handcuffs in the backseat of a police cruiser.
Rope cattle.
It's like roping cattle, an officer says. Thomas pleads, if you want to kill me, just kill me.
What? I can't. You want to kill me, just kill me.
I want to kill you. I just want to transport you.
What?
Get you some help.
Yeah. Alicia Thomas lost consciousness and later died. So, have you heard of these women? Most likely not. Because as much as we may talk about victims of police violence, we don't often hear about it when the victims are women of color. And that is what New York attorney Andrea Ritchie sets out to change in her new book, Invisible No More, Police Violence Against Black Women and Women of Color. And Andrea Ritchie joins us now in the studio. You know, we wanted to open the segment with those examples, in part just to give people a very visceral sense as to what women, some women of color have experienced at the hands of law enforcement in this country. But it suddenly occurs to me that these are actually exceptions, perhaps, to the rule, because some video was captured in their interactions with law enforcement. Why is so much of what happens to women of color and police violence invisible, as you write about in your book?
It's true that many interactions that police officers have with black women, women of color, take place away from the views of cameras or cop watchers, or they take place in private locations like homes or welfare offices or clinics or responses to domestic violence calls, policing of prostitution, sort of more private locations. But what's also, I think, particularly disturbing is that they also take place in plain view, and we in some ways just don't see them. I was noting, I mean, those are always hard recordings to hear, but I was noticing that, you know, Alicia Thomas says, I can't breathe repeatedly, but we don't associate that with her in the same way that we do with Eric Garner, right? And Roseanne Miller was put in a chokehold, and we talk often about the chokehold that killed Eric Garner, and thankfully Roseanne Miller lived to tell the tale. But women are put in chokeholds every day on the street in ways that we don't frequently talk about. So I think the message of the book is that if we look more carefully where we're already looking, women will come into view, whether we're talking about police shootings or stops and frisks or the kinds of encounters like Roseanne Miller kind of on the street, outside the home, in the community. And if we look where we're not looking now, even more women will come into view. So Alicia Thomas's arrest was taking place in the context of child welfare enforcement.
Right.
And that's a place that we don't tend to think of when we think of, you know, where is policing happening and where is abusive policing happening? But there it was. And in her case, resulted in her death in police custody on the way to the precinct, kind of like Freddie Gray died on the way to the police precinct.
So
right?
Can you tell us a little bit more about exactly what happened to Thomas?
In her case, she dropped two children off at the police station because she couldn't care for them anymore. Instead of trying to figure out what was going on and how to support her, the officer showed up at her house to arrest her for neglect and abandonment of her children. So that's why you hear the officer saying that they're trying to help her, although kicking someone repeatedly while they're saying they can't breathe and passing out doesn't sound like help to me.
Right.
And what happened after that is the officer took a break and smoked a cigarette for 30 minutes before discovering that Alicia Thomas was dead. So I think that's the other big lesson that we take from women's experiences is that the way that police officers profile and treat Black women of and women of color when they're interacting with them kind of in more obvious enforcement context, like the Roseanne Miller situation or the Sandra Bland situation, those same patterns of behavior reproduced when the police officers are in so-called helping roles,
right,
when they're responding to calls for a mental health crisis, when they're responding to calls for help, like in a domestic violence case or in a case where it's supposedly about child welfare.
So there are many facets to this issue. It's a huge issue, and we're not going to get to them all, but there are a couple that you write about in your book that I want to dive into with more detail. And one of them is the fact that quite often we hear of cases of officer misconduct, but what we're really talking about is sexual assault onto women and women of color. I mean, many people must have heard about the recent case in New York City about two officers who are currently facing trial for allegedly raping an 18-year-old in the back of a police van following pulling her over for possessing marijuana in her car. In your book, you talk about how police sexual violence is the second most frequently reported form of misconduct, but it's definitely not the second most commonly talked about form. Now, why is that?
I mean, there's so many reasons for that. And I think that the current national conversation that we're having about sexual violence and harassment and rape gives us some of the answers, which is that it's very difficult for women to come forward to talk about sexual violence and harassment when it happens in anyone's case. It's that much harder when the person who committed the sexual harassment or assault or extortion is the person you're supposed to report it to, right? And the only place to go to report police violence, police sexual violence, is the police. So not only did that case in the Brooklyn teen case, did what you just described happen, but then when she was at the hospital trying to get a rape kit done, 9 police officers showed up in her hospital room and started intimidating her and her mother, trying to convince them not to do the rape kit, which ultimately found DNA from one of the officers. So that's what happens, and that's why we don't hear as much about it, one reason.
So how do we improve the situation then? Because from my reading of your book and this conversation, you have a fundamental concern with the very nature of policing and how and the effect that has on women of color, and I'd say more broadly women also in general.
Absolutely.
And that's a very serious charge. So how do we change that?
I think that, you know, it's not one that I necessarily set out to make. It's just one that is made by the reality of women of color's experiences of policing, is that this is not working to make women of color safer. And so we need to think about what it is that we need to do. So I think the example of mental health crises is a good one, because half of police shootings involve police responding to someone in a mental health crisis. So if we just found another way to respond to someone in a mental health crisis, we would cut the number of police shootings in half. There's a solution. If we approach drugs as a public health problem and not as a criminal problem, then we wouldn't be giving officers licenses to go into women's vaginas or go into anyone's body cavities looking for drugs. We would say, what help do you need?
Yeah.
You know, if we thought of different ways of responding to domestic violence that didn't involve sending in someone who has only 3 tools, a gun, handcuffs, and maybe pepper spray and a taser, and whatever skills they might have, you know, people skills they might have. But really, their tools are contain, control, arrest. And so if we send someone in who actually had the skills to deal with the complexity of domestic violence situations, then we might get different results.
This point seems to be exceedingly important to me, because underlying that, there's this idea that oftentimes we're asking officers to do things that we shouldn't be asking law enforcement to do at all. I mean, because in some cases, it's, you know, women who need the protection of law enforcement, you know, who when things go wrong. I mean, police are still there, ideally, to protect vulnerable communities, right?
There's no question that people need protection in that situation. And the question is, like, what that should look like and what's going to actually generate safety both in the immediate and in the long term, and what's going to fundamentally transform our society such that the violence doesn't take place in the first place. Yeah. And that's where we need to be looking. That's where we need to be going.
Well, Andrea Ritchie's new book is Invisible No More, Police Violence Against Black Women and Women of Color. Thank you so much for coming in today.
Thank you so much for having me and for your really thoughtful questions. I appreciate you.